Welcome to the No BS Spiritual Book Club's live streaming interview series, where leading New Thought teachers, speakers, and authors share the intimate stories behind the 10 best spiritual books that inspired them the most on their spiritual journey. From well-known classics to hidden gems you might never have heard of, the No BS Spiritual Book Club saves you time and money by sharing reliable recommendations from those who've walked the path before you. The No BS Spiritual Book Club, the only No BS guide to the best spiritual books to inspire your own journey of self-discovery. Here's your host, founder of the No BS Spiritual Book Club, Sandy Sedgebeer.
Hello and welcome. It's not often one gets to meet a practicing psychologist who writes spiritual science fiction books and blogs with titles like Do Our Thoughts Create Our Reality? Dream Interpretation and Time Traveling, Using Light to Protect and Heal, and Keeping One Foot in the Invisible World. So I, for one, am really looking forward to hearing the stories behind Susan Plunkett's 10 Best Spiritual Books. And a little bit about Susan before we begin. She received her doctorate at the New School for Social Research in 1989 and has been in private practice in New York City for the last 32 years. She's a member of the editorial advisory board of Quadrant, the journal of the C.G. Jung Foundation of New York. And she says that the favorite part of her work, unsurprisingly, is interpreting dreams. Susan's currently working on book three of her trilogy, in which she explores the worlds of the fourth and fifth dimensions while living in the third dimension in Greenwich Village. Susan Plunkett, welcome.
Thank you, Sandy. I'm delighted to be talking to you.
Likewise. Now, you said that the process of thinking about which 10 books to choose amounted to a day spent in a kind of life review. So tell me a bit about that.
Exactly. I started, I didn't walk right to my bookshelves. I started thinking about what was the first book that really shook my world and my consciousness. And it was Seth Speaks. It wasn't the first spiritual book I love, but it really shook me up. There we go, Seth.
Yeah.
And I think it frightened me. And several times I had to put it down because I was in my early 20s at the time. I recently reread it at age 73, and I understand why my younger self was so shaken up, because it said things like, you're living all your lives simultaneously. Reincarnation is not spread out in a timeline. It's all happening at once. All ages, there's no time. Everything is going on at one time, and you're creating everything. As easily as you speak words, your thoughts are creating the reality you live in. And that was a mind-blowing thing to me. It was also a little mind-blowing to read about Jane Roberts, who up in Elmira, New York, was having a relationship with this disincarnate being from the formless realm, Seth. And I was just, I guess I was just shaken up and bowled over and even had trouble sleeping, but couldn't leave it alone and had to read all of Seth. So those were the first ideas that we're living all our lives simultaneously. I had always believed in reincarnation, not always, I wasn't that old, but you know, since I was a teenager, believed in reincarnation, but I thought it happened sequentially. And now I understand that everything is happening at once. There's really no time. And we're not just us, you know, we're part of an oversoul that's made up of our many selves. But it was an amazingly powerful thought that we're creating reality, including physical reality, according to Seth. We think it, and we have a feeling about it, and it gets created.
Would you say that book turned on your light, or would you say the light was glimmering before that?
I think it turned on my light. I think I was, you know, a naive girl in my 20s. I, you know, used the I Ching as a teenager, and I read the tarot cards as a teenager, but, you know, I didn't know what I was doing. That book, like, shook my foundation.
How did you come across it?
I have no idea. I think I went into a bookstore in Greenwich Village on 8th Street. There used to be this wonderful bookstore called the 8th Street Bookstore. Piled high, chalk books falling off the shelves, a wonderful multi-level, multi-story place. And I was always rummaging around in there. And I think I might have just seen a display of it and saw Jane Roberts' picture and the sign that she was channeling. And I just had to know more about it. So I tried to get my then boyfriend to read it too, but he was wigged out by it. He was a musician and he was like, this is too crazy for me.
Yeah, I can imagine. Your list, have you done it chronologically in the order that you read these books?
I did it pretty much chronologically. The second book, the Bhagavad Gita, I was younger, but I put the Seth Speaks because it was so powerful for me.
Right.
But it was pretty much chronological, except for putting Seth up there.
Right. Okay. Because you've got the Gita at number 8 on your list, and I just wondered whether it was. But that's okay. So the second book then, Nature, Ralph Waldo Emerson. What was it about that book? I mean, did that blow your mind, or did it just give you a little bit more, evidence?
It stimulated me and excited me. It wasn't mind-blowing like the Seth book would later be, but I was taking a college course on transcendentalism because at that time I was an English major. And I had a wonderful professor, and Dr. Bird, an older man, he was probably the age I am now, but I was 18 or 19 at the time. And I remember reading it in my college bed, as I used to read everything in bed with a pen, and getting so excited about it, just getting so excited that the divine was in every tree, that the divine was in every leaf, you know, that everything was alive with spirit, not just alive with its roots and everything, but was alive with spirit. So that idea didn't frighten me the way Seth did. It excited me, and I had to write a paper on it, and I was, you know, longhand, and then pecking it out on a typewriter back then. And I was so excited to write that paper. You know, I couldn't scribble, you know, with my pencil and my yellow pad fast enough to talk about these ideas that Emerson was. And then I came to just love Emerson because he was a great journaler. And you could just look into his mind. But it was the idea of everything vibrating and being alive that I just loved so much from this book.
Was your paper about how the book affected you?
No, the paper was about Emerson's ideas about nature. And I hadn't thought of nature that way, even though I grew up in the country. I grew up in upstate New York outside of a little town called Woodstock. And so I lived on a mountain called Bostock Mountain. And so I was always in nature and loved every season, and I loved the change. But I hadn't thought of it as the divine, you know, in every sparrow that falls, and the divine feeling every sparrow that falls, because it is every sparrow that falls. And that concept was exciting. I was vibrating, you know, with the Seth, I was I was scared and anxious and hungry to understand. But these ideas, in Emerson's ideas, were much gentler and less radical for
more
me.
More comforting.
More comforting. Yeah, that's the word. Yeah.
So when you got your paper back, there was just one comment on there.
Yeah.
What did Dr. Bird say?
I never got good comments because I'm an intuitive, and intuitives are not good writers because we just make these leaps. So I was always criticized. But when Dr. Bird gave me back the paper he wrote on it, my only regret is that I have but 100 points with which to recognize the merits of this paper. And I think I saved that paper with that comment for 20 years because I was always told, oh, you don't know how to write. You don't think logically, you know. Jung had the same problem. Freud was a brilliant writer because Freud was a thinking type, but Jung was an intuitive, and intuitives they're not easy to follow. So I was always getting marked off, but this one time I didn't.
And you obviously love Jung's work because number three on your list is Memories, Dreams, and Reflections.
Yes. I love Jung and I love Jung's work. I love this man. I mean, of course I've never met him, but I did go on a pilgrimage to his tower on Lake Zurich. And I did visit his home in Zurich, in Kunstnacht, and see his consulting room. And it was just the most divine experience of my life to go to Switzerland and walk along Lake Zurich and through the trees, see his tower that he built with his hands, which was a place that lived in my imagination for so many years. And then it was there in physical reality. I almost couldn't believe that it was there in physical reality. I love Jung because he's a mystic. I also love Freud, but Jung is a better match for my way because he was a spirit. He felt that therapy was about one finding the divine in oneself and one accepting the bigger self. You know, he says this wonderful sentence, statement, there is another who lives in us that we do not know. And we have to meet that other. And then whatever problems or neuroses we have, we become bigger than them. And they're not a problem anymore. We don't cure our neuroses. In a way, they cure us because they set us on a journey to meet that other that lives within. So Jung is like
your hero.
He's my hero. Yeah, he's my hero. He's my hero. You have the best word for things. Comfort, hero. You just get it. I blather on and you like make sense of it. Usually that's what I'm supposed to do for clients.
Yeah, I'm the therapist now. So there is a river, the story of Edgar Cayce. What a beautiful, beautiful story. What a wonderful man he was. Tell us at what point did you come across that book?
In young adulthood, because like the tarot and the I Ching, Edgar Cayce was a part of my adolescence. I knew of him as people, we knew of him as this interesting fellow. But he's another one who like breaks your heart, you know, to read about his life. It just breaks your heart. And several times I've read this book and other biographies, but I love this one the best because this person knew him. And you know, his process fascinated me, the way he helped people. And it wasn't so much his information, but he was so selfless. I mean, he was just so selfless. I mean, I can't imagine being that selfless. I wish I could, but he was so selfless, just such a beautiful man. And the he would wait for things and wait for things, like to marry the woman he loved. The patience and selflessness. Sorry, I interrupted you there.
No, I was just going to say, what did you take from that book? I mean,
that we have, that we humans have the ability to contact other dimensions, other realities, and receive information from the formless realm. He was contacting the Akashic Records, which we all can have the power to contact the Akashic Records, but we also all can receive information from the formless realm if we don't block it. I'm fearful of that, having been told years ago that I was a channel, and I too frightened. Just too.
Why?
I guess I was afraid, oh, I'll lose myself. I don't want to do that. But those beings in the formless realm to whom I am connected because I made an agreement before this incarnation, they have found a way to work with me where they don't, I'm not a voice channel, where they download in the sleep state whatever they want, and I write it the next day. And I remember some of it as dreams, but I think I'm making it up when I'm writing. But this shaman that I work with, this Australian daughter of an Aborigine, she said, "You're not making up anything. You're just a scribe. So you're supposed to be a scribe. You're a scribe and just scribe away. I see you in many lifetimes simultaneously scribing with quill pens and now in this one with the." So that's going on. And also when I'm working with patients, sometimes something just drops in, like dropped from heaven unasked, that I'm supposed to convey. And I know that it is not coming from my brain. So then I will just share that. I can't ask for anything, but if it comes, then, I mean, I guess I could, but I don't.
So even in your professional life, you're being a scribe in a way, you're being an interpreter, aren't you?
Yeah. Partly like what you doing with me now, making sense of the jumble of words that I'm saying, to say a word like comfort or hero. Because when you give a word like that, it crystallizes something for me and when I do it for the patient, the client. But Edgar Cayce, in all his gentleness, showed me that there's many ways to contact other realms to be helpful.
When you share information that you've downloaded or say something to a client, do you tell them? I mean, do you tell them where it's coming from?
No. Sometimes I might say, you know, I have a feeling or I'm getting an intuition. Yeah. But they've signed up to come to see Dr. Plunkett. They don't want to see this other aspect. Yeah. Some of them do. But even then, I don't say that.
Yeah. Book number 5 is an interesting one because I had never heard of this book or this person before. However, she came up 3 weeks ago in another interview with somebody who was had a wonderful story to tell about her. But it's Daughter of Fire, Diary of a Spiritual Training with a Sufi Master by Irina Tweedy.
A British woman like you.
Yeah.
Look at that face and those eyes.
So how did you come across this book and when?
I came across this book probably in my 40s, which is now some time ago. Also in a bookstore because I was a little interested in Sufism. And so I was looking in that section and I liked the cover, and this is also a book I've read multiple times. trying to grasp the essence of her relationship with her guru and understanding the nature of surrender to the process. And I loved her because she was struggling so much and she would get so pissed off at the way she was treated. And she was just so honest, and she suffered in India in the heat, the mosquitoes, you know, she was just so honest about it all. I just loved her.
So, and so what happened to her in the end?
She did. She triumphed. When her guru died, when he transcended, she went back to the UK and she taught. But she, as she wrote this book, she understood everything she'd been through. And he told her she was going to write the book. He told her she should do it, and she went, you know. She was like me when I was first told that I had to be a scribe. No, I'm not doing it, just like you. No, I'm not going to do this thing, this book. No, I'm not going to do it. So she was fussing about it, but then she did it and everything pulled together. Just, yeah. What story did you hear about her?
This gentleman who probably one of the most dedicated readers, seekers of information, of truth that I've ever come across. He would read, you know, volumes of the most esoteric, hard to understand. And he was reading her book, and he had some, I think he was trying to rush it. And then one day he was in a coffee bar and he was ordering some coffee, and there was a little old lady standing there, and he kind of went to move across her to get something, and she turned around and looked at him and said, "Will you stop rushing me?" And he said she looked just like her. And it was only later that he thought it was her. It was a message saying, "Don't rush me," you know. And he went back to the book and took his time with it and found it to be well worth reading.
Yeah. No, it's wonderful. It's to be savored. It's big. You know, it's like a big book. But.
Yeah. You said in your write-up about it, she learned how to live with God as a living reality, to relax within the endlessness of love, to rest in God, body and mind, even while doing housework or shopping. Yes. Wow. So what do you think, what was the big takeaway from that book, beyond admiring her tenacity and her, you know, ability to just stick with it? What was the big takeaway for you?
That the divine lives within us as us. The divine lives within us as us. And that is just such an empowering thought, that the divine isn't out there somewhere just in the trees and the sky. The divine is in every heart that beats. Everything. Every atom of everything, you know.
Because
everything is made of atoms, and every atom is divine.
Yeah.
That became clear.
So book number 6, Florence Scovel Shinn, Reader, Her Ageless Wisdom for Today. It's definitely a woman ahead of her time.
Yeah, I think it was a patient who first told me that I should, because said, you know, Susan, you sound so much like Florence Scovel Shinn. And I said, "Who's Florence Scovel Shinn?" And the patient told me, and she said, "You really should read her." And so I got her book, and that was probably 20 some years ago that I read her book. And now the same ideas that she is talking about are very popular by this motivational speaker, Abraham,
Esther Hicks.
Esther Hicks, right, yeah. Channels Abraham. And Esther and Abraham say the same things that Florence was saying in the 1930s. And I did, at the patient's suggestion, read it, and then I got her Florence Scovel Shin cards, so you can just pick a card every day. But it's basically the law of attraction. It's basically take responsibility for what you're creating. The words you speak become the house you live in.
Yeah.
Mm. And you're creating reality with your thoughts.
It's interesting how the same information, the same, I mean, it's all fundamental, you know, so it's going to turn up again and again. We have to hear it in so many different ways before some of us get it.
Mm. No, and I'm grateful for all of these different ways of hearing it.
Yeah. So book number 7 was Heaven and Hell by Emanuel Swedenborg.
Yes. Here he is. This is a little esoteric. This is a thick book too. This is a little hard going, but the main takeaway for me from him is happiness is within only. We are totally responsible for our state and our happiness. We don't need to look anywhere outside of us because we're creating it. And we can summon angels, and as did Blake, and talk to angels. And he's writing in the 1700s,
yeah,
saying the same, making the point that you're just making. He was telling people of his time what we're saying now, what Florence was saying in the 30s, and Abraham is saying now. So I wrote down, and I've had this book so long that it has bite marks from a cat that's been dead for 20 years. Because that one cat used to chew all my books.
Not just that one.
No, chewed the corners on all my books.
Yeah. One of the things that you said in your review of this one was that he writes about how modern man, and he's talking about modern man in the 1700s, had lost touch with his inner senses and focused too much on outer reality. Nothing changes.
Nothing changes. Jung was saying that at the turn of the century, into this century. And he was saying it in the 1700s.
Yeah, yeah. What do you think it's going to take?
I think more people are hearing it. But life is so fast now. Do people slow down enough to, I mean, I think maybe not in their teen years or in their 20s, but maybe after 30, some of us start to think more seriously and can look inward. But the inward looking is just so rewarding.
Yeah. Well, the world we live in is not very conducive to reflection and contemplation. It doesn't give us much time.
No.
We have to fight for that.
Yeah.
Book number 7, The Gita, Stephen Mitchell's translation.
Oh, the Bhagavad Gita.
Yeah.
Oh, Stephen Mitchell is such a poet. This book, when I was 17 and I first went away to college, the school had an Indian, a visiting professor from India, and he had us read the Upanishads. And my favorite part of the Upanishads was the Bhagavad Gita, which is where, as you know, Krishna is speaking to Arjuna on the battlefield, and Arjuna doesn't want to fight. And Krishna is the divine, posing as Arjuna's charioteer and talking to him and talking about the nature of reality and the nature of life. And this is a love song to God, this book. This is just a love song to God. So if you like poetry and you want great wisdom about how the divine resides, again, the same message within each of us, then the Bhagavad Gita is so worth. I think I quoted to you, and I will just say, when Krishna is describing the divine, he says, "I am the taste in water, the light in the moon and sun. I am the sacred syllable Om in the Vedas, the sound of air. I am the fragrance in the earth, the manliness in men, the brilliance in fire, the life in the living, the abstinence in ascetics. I am the primal seed within all beings. It's just so stunningly beautifully translated too by Stephen Mitchell.
And you said that thinking of God as the primal seed within all beings offered your teenage self a way to understand that we are each divine.
Yeah, and I think I might have grasped it for that semester and then lost it. And, you know, not to find it again, maybe a little in Seth, but not to find it again until I was at least over 30.
Book 8, it's interesting because few of your books have been recommended before. Obviously, the Gita and Irina Tweedy book, but I don't think any of the others have been. Well, Seth material, of course. But yeah. You're the first person to talk about the Ra material. James McCarthy, Don Elkins, Carla Ruckert, many, many people. You know, I come across many people who found this work to be quite profound.
Profound. Life-changing. I came to this work later in life, through a dream, actually. I kept dreaming of this, I want to say multiplex being named Ra, but I don't know how to describe Ra, but Ra's not one being, but we're not even one being either. So, and I kept dreaming Ra, Ra, Ra. Why am I dreaming this about Ra, Ra, Ra? So I Googled Ra and found that Ra was a group of entities that had lived on Venus. And then I found the Ra material, the Law of One, and I quickly read all 7 books, volumes of it, and loved it, just loved it, and was in awe of what they did and the risks they took. Carla, who you know, nearly died several times channeling this material because... Yeah. There were entities that did not want this material to come through to us, did not want us to know what was going on. More than any other book I've ever read, this gave me a framework for what could be happening on Earth, possibly on other planets too, but definitely, like, when you start asking the question, as I did to my first grade teacher, Miss McGinnis, when I was supposed to be adding numbers, and I was looking out the window. She said, "What are you doing?" I said, "You're not doing this." As she would walk up and down the rows. I said, I'm thinking. I'm trying to understand what we're all doing here. And she crushed me. She said, "Aren't you Christian?" And I had no idea as a 6-year-old what that could have to do with what I was asking. Because I was asking her something really important, not something about where I went on Sunday, which was meaningless to me. For that question, I got my desk moved away from the window to the bulletin board side of the room. But I know that I was asking that question from a very little girl. And this book answered that question in a way that even knowing that we're all divine didn't answer it. Because the Ra material lays out a kind of a program and a path for ascension and what we have to do to move from one dimension to another. And it was so comforting. It was totally comforting. You know, Freud said the 2 great fears, you know, are fear of other people and fear of death. After you read the Ra material, if you really understand it, you're never afraid of death again. So I think, you know, I'm just amazed at what Carla did and the risks she took. And what was, you know her, you knew her. What was she like?
I did know her. And at the time, I hadn't studied her work. So I really didn't know the significance. I just met her through somebody. I was living in the area where she lived at the time, and we became lunch companions. I used to go to her house and attend some of her channeling sessions. And yeah, we used to go out to lunch together. She was, I probably didn't take advantage, as much advantage as I, you know, wish I had now, because the conversations that we could have had, I don't think I was prepared for at that time. But yeah, I really enjoyed her company. And I was very sad when she passed.
Yeah.
But she was very dedicated to this work, very dedicated.
Yeah. The whole team was. In fact, one of the team may actually have died, because at dawn may have died, gone, it might have driven him crazy.
Yes, you know, well, she did. She did intimate that.
Yeah, because since they couldn't kill her, they wanted to get, you know, him, or they wanted to get one of them, but primarily Carla or Dawn, and I guess they did get Dawn.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. You say that this book, this body of work, affected your own writing, and Ra's ideas underpin your own trilogy.
Yes. Especially the first book, which is Mission from Venus, which is where beings from around the universe are, a call goes out across the universe asking higher dimensional beings to come and train for a mission to Earth, to incarnate as human, because according to the raw material which Carla channeled, interference is not really allowed on our planet. There's a quarantine around Earth, which was put there after people from Mars were brought here and genetically altered because they were too warlike. And the Council of Nine, this is everything I'm telling you now is information Carla channeled from Ra. The Council of Nine, responsible for Earth, determined that there shouldn't be, interference with our genes after they interfered with the Martians. So a quarantine was put around. And so the only way to legitimately come to Earth to be of help is to incarnate as a human baby and grow up and then wake up and remember that you're a higher dimensional being. But it's very hard to wake up in this dimension because, as Seth is always saying, we're so focused on external reality. And we think it's so real. It's not real, we're just creating it, but we think it's real, so that it's so compelling, this reality we create with our thoughts, that we don't look within much and realize who we really are. So I'm using that basic understanding of what's going on. And I have this group of wanderers. They wander, they incarnate on Earth as human infants. And I'm following 8 of them as they grow up, find one another again, and wake up. Because if you don't wake up, if you're a higher dimensional being that incarnates here and you don't wake up, then you just have to, you're stuck here. You have to keep incarnating as a human again and again, and you lose all your higher dimensional abilities. So Ra forms sort of the underpinning of my story. His, what Ra says, what Carla said. In fact, in one of the last books, Carla, Dawn, and Jim reveal that they are wanderers. They were wanderers from higher dimension. Because Ra has told them that they are. And there are, according to Ra, millions of higher dimensional beings incarnate now on Earth. And Ra named in the work that Carla channeled some beings from the past who were wanderers. Benjamin Franklin, for example, was a wanderer. Tesla was a wanderer, to name a few. I forget who else they talked about, but they don't remember that once they pass through the veil of forgetting. We don't know who we were. Unless, I mean, the way to get round the veil is through your dreams, because you can dream of your past lives. Well, they're really your simultaneous lives. And you can dream of your lives even on other planets. I have dreamt of myself living on other planets. I have dreamt of myself seeing the Earth from outer space. So our dreams free us to know ourselves in a much bigger way. And Seth talks a lot about the value of dreams. Ra also talks about the value of dreams. But Ra, more than any of these other books, lays it out. Like, Earth is in the third dimension, moving into the fourth dimension. If you don't hold enough light, when you die, you can't come back to Earth, because Earth is going to be fourth dimensional. You have to go to some other planet, which is still third dimensional. And he just lays it out, how it's all decided. And like, there's only, it's so simple, service to others, like Edgar Cayce did, or Jung did, or you do, service to others. That's the path. There's no new tools on the block. You can either be in service to self or service to others. And we see that. We see that around the world. We really see it in America. There's one group, service to self. Yeah. It's about me, my needs, what I want, protecting myself, what I have and what my kind has. And then there's another group, which is, I don't want anything for myself that I don't also want for every being. And that's a very different mentality.
Yeah.
And Ra talks about that. These books were channeled in 1981, 1982, 1983, before the dark lords of Orion, or whoever these dark beings were, ended Don's life after failing two or three times to end Carlos. But I think there was the alchemy necessary of Carla, Don, and Jim for Ra to find the narrow band to come through. And without the three of them, the band wasn't available for Ra to transmit. So he did end the communication, but a lot of information was delivered, which is amazing and reassuring. And and you begin to see the separation on Earth right now between in service to others and in service to self. And those in service, there's nothing to worry about, because those in service to self, when they die, they're going somewhere else. Earth will be, you know, 30, 40 years ago, a channel, the one who first said that I could channel, said, in a couple hundred years, this will be paradise on Earth. So don't be afraid. You know, I won't be alive to see that, but not in this form anyway.
No, not in this form. Yeah. So of these books, which is the one that you would really put at the top of your list? The most impactful?
I think I would put the Ra material at the top of the list.
You would?
Yeah, because it transformed my idea about what's happening on the planet, as well as gave me an understanding of spiritual life. Whereas all the others were helping me to understand that every atom is divine. But they didn't explain what was happening. Even Seth, he says we're creating our reality with our thoughts and emotions, but only the Ra material like lays it out. That's why I use that as the basis for the first book, and you know, made a fictionalized version and created these four pairs of twin flames to incarnate, and then try to wake up in this dimension and do their work.
So what's in the second book? The same characters?
The same characters. In the first book, they're on Venus training. And so a lot of information is shared. in the training, different types of meditation. They visit Earth as part of the training, but it's the first book is set on Venus in the sixth dimension, not the Venus. We only perceive from the third dimension, Venus in the third dimension, which is an atmosphere of sulfuric acid. But Venus is simultaneously existing in all dimensions. And so this book is set in Venus in the sixth dimension. The second book is called The Wanderers on Earth. These eight are here. They're growing up as children around the world in eight different countries. And they're starting to know that they're different. And already the Dark Lords are attacking them and trying to kill them, even as children. And the second book opens when they're 21. And they're starting to find each other again, and they're starting to realize that they are wanderers from the fifth dimension. And then they reunite, and the group of eight comes back together. And they try to help bring consciousness to humans that this is the time of ascension to the fourth dimension. And we want as many people as possible to wake up and understand that they're divinity and that they're all one, that we're all one. Like Ross says, the law of one, that we're all one. So that's the second book. And the third book I'm writing now.
And how far have you got?
I think I'm probably between a third and a half, because these books have come out to be about 120,000 words and I'm about 50,000 words. And I don't know how long it will be or what's coming, because I wait until I dream something and then I write. And, you know, it doesn't happen every day, but many days in a row. And then there seems to be a break and then resumes.
So how long have you been writing these?
I started writing around 2015 when Cindy Dale, who is she's an energy healer and she's an intuitive and you know who she is maybe. Yeah. She told me, you're supposed to be writing, you're supposed to be writing. It's 1 degree in Minnesota and I'm burning up. I'm on fire and they're telling me to tell you this. And so I started writing something I could write, because I wasn't receiving information. I wrote a memoir, When Every Breath Becomes a Prayer, about the death of my sister and other things. And so I kind of taught myself how to write in that book. Because as we know, I was always told, you can't write, you're a bad writer. So then the shaman that I work with, the daughter of the Aborigine, Australian Aborigine, she said, you're supposed to be writing a trilogy. They're telling me it's a trilogy, it's a trilogy. It's about what's happening on Earth. Don't worry about it. It's all going to be downloaded. You're just a scribe. So Cindy got me going. And then Carrie Henwood, the daughter of the Aborigine, told me it was a trilogy. I said, oh yeah, now it's a trilogy I have to write. But it's been wonderful. It's been wonderful. So the first book took a year. The second book took a year. The third book, I'm already over 2 years. It's a different order of information. It's more layered. It's information that I hadn't read in any of my books before. So that's the book I'm writing on.
Are you self-publishing these?
No, John Hunt, who's a British.
Yes.
It's kind of a combination of, you don't get much, you get royalties, but you know, not many people have read my books, to tell you the truth. So, but yeah, and you know something else? I don't know how I found John Hunt. I got an email. So I must have sent the manuscript, the first one. And then he published the second one, and I hope he'll do the third one. But it's a wonderful little company, works on a shoestring, and they're good. They're really good and nice and make it possible for unknowns to get their work published.
Yeah, they actually do publish some good books, very good books. Are they available on Amazon?
They're on Amazon. They're on Amazon. All three of them are out now on Amazon. And I'm not rushing to do the fourth one. I mean, you know, the third one. I'm just letting them dictate it. As it comes, it comes. And it's given my life like a nice structure, because I write in the mornings and I see clients in the afternoons and evenings, and that's my whole life. So no little kids to take care of, just a dog and two cats. So
people may have noticed that we're one book missing, and we're missing a book because you couldn't choose between several. So you actually came up with six.
Yeah.
that you really do love and reread often. We'll just skate through these ones because we don't have the time to talk about them all. But there was Letters to a Young Poet by Rilke.
Yes.
The Essential Rumi, War and Peace, The Collected Works, Jung, Cosmos, Carl Sagan, and A Writer's Diary, Virginia Woolf.
Yeah.
Interesting collection there. So if I pinned you against the wall and said pick one, what would it be?
I knew it when you said them.
Essential Rumi?
No, it wasn't Essential Rumi.
Letters to a Young Poet?
No, but I could make a case for any of them.
Cosmos?
Cosmos was wonderful, but I'm sorry.
A Writer's Diary, The Collected Works, Jung, or War and Peace?
War and Peace, War and Peace, War and Peace.
Really? War and Peace.
Tolstoy, another hero. He said, "Everything I know because of love." And I just love that man. I love his writing. I find his writing so beautiful. But I find that sentiment in page after page. I didn't care about all the military descriptions, but the characters and the depth of their being. He elevates humans to a potential that's very beautiful, and his attention to the detail in character is so beautiful. I mean, I could make a case for any of them, but I love Tolstoy. I love Anna Karenina also. But War and Peace I could read once a year.
So that's the first fiction book in your list of favorites. Yeah. Have you learned anything about writing from that book?
Probably I haven't been able to use what I've learned, because when you're writing about higher dimensional beings, it's hard to develop their character because they're supposed to be so good. Because Tolstoy has the most beautiful character descriptions. He has all the Jungian archetypes, you know, in his characters. So if I were ever going to write a novel, I would want to write the way Virginia Woolf and Tolstoy write. But that's a challenge when you're writing spiritual fiction, like I'm writing, because how do you make the characters interesting and compelling when they're higher dimensional beings and they're supposed to just be good? Well, I do have bad guys, but the bad guys are so bad and the good guys are so good that everybody's kind of a little one-dimensional. So,
Well, you know, the advice to writers of fiction is make sure your characters are three-dimensional, but in your case, they're not the sixth-dimensional.
Yeah, true.
Yeah. So how do you give them their own identities and personalities?
Well, I think I didn't do too well in the first book, although Here's a secret of something that I did. I love this show, Downton Abbey. And some of the women, the twin flame women, I modeled after those personalities, like giving them, like, for example, the character Rose is loosely, they're very similar to Sona, because she's exuberant and like, whoa, and full of love. And then Mary's a little prickly, and Mary's kind of Maeplida, Rose is kind of Sonam, Edera is a little like Edith. Or sometimes I'll think of an actor that I would like to play the part if it was a movie, and then I think of characteristics of them. And try to formulate that a little, just so that people can see the character. Because fifth dimensional beings are made of light, you know, and they're not usually jealous, and they're not motivated by greed and all the things that make, you know, some fiction juicy.
A good story, yeah.
Yeah, make a good story. Yeah. So I kind of, how do I make my story interesting?
Yeah. What do you think, you know, you've talked about this book as if it's channeled material. What do you think the point is? Somebody's trying to make a point. Somebody's trying to continue this information.
Yeah. According to the shaman, she said that I made an agreement in the formless realm. I sat in some council with other beings in the formless realm and agreed to be a scribe because I wouldn't remember anything when I incarnated, but that I agreed to be the scribe for them. And it's the same message that we've talked about in all these books. We are all one, we are all divine, we are each creating our reality. The words you speak become the house you live in. That's Rumi. But that's really Seth. That's all of them. The thought, but you know, I would go further. I would say the thoughts you think become the house you live in. That's Abraham.
Yeah.
So Rumi said, the words you say become the house you live, but it's really the thoughts you think. So that's the message of this trilogy. We're all one. We're all divine. You're creating your reality. There's no one to blame. No one's a victim. You're living many lives simultaneously. Wake up. Wake up. Wake up. A message that everyone gets, not a new message. Mm-hmm. I'm receiving the same message as everyone, just one more vehicle, except that the shaman also said maybe after your death your books will be more widely read, because you know, it takes time. I'm reading books of all, I mean, Swedenborg was in the 1700s and I read his book in the 2000s, you know.
Absolutely. Yeah. So what are you reading now?
What am I reading now? Oh, I'm reading one of the books one of your authors recommend. You know, that's the problem with watching your show.
Oh, believe me, I've got a list this high.
Yeah, I start going and ordering the books. I can get, it's over on the other side of the room, I can go get it and show it. But I forget the title, but it's one of your people's books. That's the only thing I've been reading lately, is what I order.
Oh, after. Well, now I have to know. Go and get it.
Okay. Oh, shoot, where do I put it? No, it isn't on the other side of the room. I stuck it back in the shelf, I think. Oh, it was sitting there and I was tidying up.
Now there's a cliffhanger for you.
Yeah, well, I'm going to have to email it to you because we don't want to tie up your whole show. I must have put it in the bedroom next to my bed, but I'm not going to.
So is it a book that somebody recommended, or is it one of our guests had written?
It was one of your guests. After that, I ordered like three books that person recommended, and I had them piled next to the bed, and I must have carried that one back into the bedroom. But anyway, yeah, that's what I'm reading.
Is it good?
Yeah, it is good. It's nonfiction, you know, it's listing, it's the same topics. Yes. It's the same topics. It has a pretty cover. It was a woman. It was one of your women a few weeks ago.
Well,
I'm going to email it to you.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Do
what
that.
Are you reading? What are you reading? You're voracious. I know you're voracious.
Well, I have several on the go. Once. The question is, what am I reading that's really exciting me? I think the most recent book that I read was an interview I recorded yesterday for broadcast in a month or so, and it's a book called, let me think, goodness, I can't even think, it's actually by Mark Antony, who is known as the psychic lawyer And Mark Antony is a lawyer, trials lawyer. He's also psychic. His family, fourth generation psychic. And his book, what impressed me, he's a good writer. He's got some great stories in there. I mean, incredible stories. He is a medium. And he's been on The Doctors and all kinds of TV programs. And he is very well known. He's had, you know, a couple of other books that were bestsellers. But what impressed me about this book, he's talking about mediumship, connection, you know, with the afterlife, near-death visions, all of those, you know, the phenomena. And he has really done his research. And he's looking at all of the latest quantum science, neuroscience, and he's giving the evidence, the explanations for how all of it works. And I think that's probably the first time I've read such a well-thought-out book that provided so much evidence. You know, so much, gives the whole thing so much credibility. And some of his stories are just unbelievable, but, you know, they happened, and he can prove they happened.
What's the title?
I'm going to have to look this one up.
Oh, yeah, but this is so crazy that we can't even...
I read so many books that as soon as I've finished, it's like they go in one ear and then everything falls out. If you'll bear with me one moment, I'll have a look on my computer and I'll tell you what the book is called. It's called The Afterlife Frequency.
The Afterlife Frequency. I'm gonna
have to read and that's basically, you know, what he's talking about is that it literally is a different frequency, and that is what people who are communicating are able to tap into.
All the realities are all piled up on each other. It's just a different frequency. The afterlife frequency.
The afterlife frequency.
Now I have to read that one too.
Oh, I would recommend. Oh, it's not actually out until October. But
October.
It is a book, October. It, you know, you can pre-order it online. Here I am doing a great advertisement for Mark Antony. but yeah, I mean, there are some, you know, I read a lot of books because I'm doing a lot of interviews, and I tend these days only to do interviews with people that interest me. So the books interest me, but there are those standout few that really become, you know, they become my bookworms, because I want to tell everybody about them, because I think they have a lot to offer people, a great deal to offer. And I think that one certainly does for anybody who kind of half believes but isn't sure. Very compelling evidence that you can't argue with. You know, thank God for quantum science and neuroscience. It's showing us so much.
Frequency is where it's at. Frequencies.
Well, it's everything. It's everything. Well, Susan, it's been delightful to talk to you about your 10 best spiritual books and about your own journey. And where can people find out more, and where can they, you know, read about your books?
My books are available on Amazon, barnesandnoble.com. I don't know, maybe other places.
Do you mention them on your website?
Yeah. Oh, I have a website, susanplunkett.com. And Plunkett has one T. So susanplunkett.com, my books are there.
So people can find out about, they can also read your blogs, which have some very interesting titles as well. Cool.
Thank you so much, Sandy.
Thank you, Susan.
Love talking to you. And well, I'm going to get this book.
Good. Let me know what you think of it.
After October.
Well, that's it for this week. We'll be back again next week at the same time. And in the meantime, if you want to see any of the videos in this series, you can go to the No BS Spiritual Book Club. .com and click on the video interviews tab, and you'll be able to take your pick. I think there's probably about 70 or 80 of them there now. You can also sign up to our newsletter and be the first to know who's coming up next. That brings us to the end of this week's show. Thank you for joining me. See you next time.